You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, July 7th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Micah Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. I just did your thing, didn't
yeah,
I?
You did it all.
I was so distracted.
So pumped.
I was so distracted too by making sure not to say New York Times building, which I did not.
Oh, that's
say.
What threw you off.
Yes,
I got it. Today's show, we're going to be talking with Reza Aslan about the crisis. Well, I guess it's really a perpetual crisis, obviously, in Israel-Palestine, but we're going to talk about the latest eruptions. Are we heading into a third intifada? Does this status quo that's happened over the last several years under the Netanyahu government, with a perpetual occupation, with lip service to some type of two-state solution, is this coming undone? Obviously, tremendous violence there. We're going to be talking with him at 1 o'clock, so we're actually reverse ordering the show. For members and everybody else listening later to this as a podcast, everything's going to be normal because we're going to switch the sections
right.
up. But for now, if you're listening live, we're going to kind of do a better half first, which might be interesting for the public to hear. Also, we have a lot of other great stories for you. Rick Perry, owned on ABC News by Martha Raddatz. Saba Ahmed, the Muslim Republican. She's still writing about why she's so shocked that Republicans are bigoted. Well, welcome to the Muslim log cabin, Saba. Also, what else we got, Matt?
Oh, we got so much. We got a story about a poor radio host who got fired for saying something completely racist. And
goodbye.
His baby men listeners and fans just can't handle it. They just can't handle it. Also, conservatives have found a new
bad day for third-rate Howard Stern knockoff.
Yes.
Yeah, go
and
ahead.
And conservatives have found a new way to stick it to Obama, and that's by poisoning themselves. And all of us, too.
Us, too. That's the relevant part. Those stories are just unbelievable. Yeah, folks. Better half in the first half.
If you're listening live, you get a taste of the
What happens in the fun half. So
and
obviously,
if you're listening to the podcast, whether you're a member or a freebie listener, you won't notice any difference.
You won't notice any difference.
You're going to hear the Reza Aslan interview right here if you're listening to the podcast.
Oh, but actually, reset that again because we're going to fire up the IMs and the phone calls, so you
yes.
can go right now.
So yes, we're taking
yes,
IMs and
yes.
phone calls now.
Yes.
So. Do that. Send
but
us the
now
items.
We're going to take a break. But if you are listening later as a podcast, everything returns to normal.
And you will listen
now.
To Reza Aslan now.
Now.
One time. Yeah. Yeah. Yo, all I need is one mic, one beat, one stage, one... front my face on the front page. Only if I had one girl and one crib, one God to show me how to do things. The sun dead pure like a cup of virgin blood mixed with 151. One sip will make a flip, writing names on my plotting mad balance. So I'm gonna this hood politics, acknowledge it, leave bodies
wrapped up in garbages. Seeds watch us grow up and try to follow us. Police watch us roll up and try knocking us. One knee I duck, could it be my time is up? With my luck I got up, the cops again. Bus stop glass bursts, a fiend drops his Heineken, ricocheting between the spots that I'm hiding in. Blacking out, I step back, getting hit. This is my hood, I'm a rap to the death of it. To everybody, come on, little this grown hood rats. Don't abortion your wound, we need more warriors soon. Sent from the stars, sun and the moon. And it's like a police chase, street sweepers and coppers. Kids with no conscience, leaving victims from doctors. If you really think you're ready to die, with doubt, this is what Nas is about. The time is now.
One mic, one mic, one mic. All I need is one mic.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks.
And I am Matt Binder.
Joining us now, Reza Aslan. He's the author of Zealot, No God But God, a religion scholar, my sometimes boss and collaborator. Very happy to have you on, Reza. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. So I want to get, obviously, to the situation Israel-Palestine. There's a lot to get to. There's a couple of different tracks that I want us to address. And I think maybe we could start with basically what's happened in the last 24, 48 hours with the attack on Hamas militants. There's obviously been these series of killings that began, at least this cycle began, with three Israeli children being murdered. Then there's been a reprisal attack with a Palestinian youth being burned alive. And it's really horrifying, the kind of specific manifestations in which this is kind of taking aim very specifically and publicly at children. Do you think right now, from a larger perspective, before we get into the various details, I mean, is what's happening now, is this the beginning possibly of something like a third intifada? Or at the very least, is this just a clear break that this status quo that the Netanyahu government has actually been able to maintain for several years is not going to hold?
Yeah, I mean, I think it most definitely can evolve into something much bigger, much more destructive, like a third intifada. I mean, this is how these things usually begin. I mean, the first intifada, you know, involved an accidental death of a Palestinian kid. And I think the reason that so many people are on pins and needles right now is precisely because of the status quo that you're talking about. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we've been in this kind of holding pattern without any kind of movement whatsoever in the peace process. There's been an enormous amount of pessimism on both sides, a rise in those who are no longer interested in the two-state solution on both sides of the aisle. And by the way, it's not just kind of liberals and secularists and, you know, people who teach at Tel Aviv University who are now talking about the one-state solution. It's, you know, members of some of the hardline political parties in Israel who are now talking about full annexation and citizenship for Palestinians. And so, in a sense, we're in this very precarious moment where, you know, what's happening right now can very easily tip into full-scale countrywide riots. And that's something that I think would be disastrous for all sides. It would obviously be disastrous for Israel for a whole host of reasons, but really for the Palestinians as well. I mean, they are in a situation now in which the pendulum of public opinion and even media perception about the Palestinian cause has swung so wildly to their side. I mean, I haven't seen anything like this. I mean, honestly, the closest example that I can give is the way in which popular opinion so suddenly shifted in the United States when it came to same-sex marriage.
Right. Reza, I'm losing you.
Massive proportions, even among Republicans, being for it. And, you know, I mean, it's very clear that Israel is losing the propaganda war that it had won for, you know, so many decades. And an intifada, an armed uprising by Palestinians, one that could become really messy and could lead to a large number of civilian deaths, the emphasis that the Palestinian cause, the Palestinian narrative, has made in the consciousness of even Americans.
Reza?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, you just cut out for just a moment. Okay.
I was done.
Okay, yeah. So let's get to Hamas specifically then, because I think that obviously with the establishment of an agreement between Hamas and Fatah, there was this progress inside the Palestinian internal politics that I think did have overlap with the shift in public opinion you're talking about. Israel is blaming these initial deaths on Hamas of the Israeli teenagers. Hamas has denied it, but also praised the attacks. And now, with the death of the Hamas militants over this past weekend, what is the specific role that you see Hamas potentially playing or not playing in terms of how they maintain their credibility with some of their constituencies, essentially, as Israel wants Hamas to kind of become again the representative and the embodiment of Palestinians and the Palestinian cause writ large? And then obviously this kind of tenuous balance with Fatah. How does the specific Hamas thread play out in this precarious situation you're talking about?
Well, first of all, as numerous Israeli commentators, and indeed the former head of Mossad's MIA section, Missing in Action section, have repeatedly stated, there is absolutely no evidence that Hamas is responsible for the kidnappings. In fact, no evidence has been presented at all by Netanyahu. And indeed, again, as the head of Mossad MIA said, that this seems to be very clearly a statement and not an evidentiary statement. And indeed, in fact, with Netanyahu, almost immediately, the moment it was discovered that those three Israeli children were kidnapped, he began to blame Hamas,
right,
and immediately went on the offensive and spoke to the heads of state in Europe, here in the United States, to say, you have to now withdraw your support from the PA because obviously if Hamas is responsible for these kidnappings, and therefore the PA is responsible for them, and this just proves that the unity government, it cannot be supported. It was a real despicable political ploy on Netanyahu's part, to immediately use this kidnapping as a way to make some sort of, score some political points with Western powers. Now, it may very well be Hamas who is responsible for this kidnapping, though, again, as the head of Mossad, a former head of Mossad's MIA unit said, it's very likely that it was just, some Palestinian thugs, like some people who thought that they would make some money by kidnapping some kids, and that when it became an international cause, probably just ended up killing those kids to get out of the situation, because obviously they weren't going to be able to get any kind of ransom for them. So I think that's a very important point.
Right.
But what you saw in the way that Hamas handled this situation is a window into what Hamas sees for itself. They really have no political standing left anymore. They're incredibly unpopular in Gaza because of their lack of their inability, I should say, to govern that strip of land in any kind of meaningful way for the Palestinians who live there. They're still a force to be reckoned with, and I think that all, really most rational-minded people would say that a unity government is a good idea. Indeed, Netanyahu himself spent months and months and months saying that he can't have a negotiated peace deal with the Palestinians because they're divided.
Right.
And then when they became unified, he said that he can't have a peace deal with the Palestinians because they're united.
Right.
So, there's a lot of sort of cynicism here that we have to deal with. But the way that you saw Hamas deal with this is, I think, a real window into their mindset. They denied having anything to do with it, but then they praised the attack.
Yes.
And that's the problem with a resistance organization like Hamas. Hamas is not a political organization. It doesn't have sort of any kind of political gravitas whatsoever. And indeed, political participation and certainly the political process would actually rob Hamas of its raison d'etre, right? It can no longer be an opposition force if it's part of the political process. It's part of the political powers. And so it has to have this kind of delicate balance between understanding that its future lies in becoming part of a united Palestinian government, which would, of course, lessen its power. It lessen its sort of prestige and power. But at the same time, it has to maintain, you know, some sort of connectivity to its past as a resistance movement. And
it has to guard,
you know,
its brand.
In a way, it sort of is dealing with the worst of both worlds.
Right.
You know, it maintains its sort of image as a resistance power by praising, you know, this sort of senseless murder of Israeli kids, and then at the same time denies that it had anything to do with it, and tries to maintain its connection to the political authority in the PA, making life miserable for Abu Mazen.
Right. Who is, again and again and again, of all of these players, the only one who seems to have any genuine commitment to what we could, I guess, still call a peace process. I don't know, frankly, if that term is helpful to keep using, because it's so cynically deployed and has in no way been a reality for, you know, at the minimum over a decade. So I think if we could get more actually then into defining, and this will play a significant role in how the Palestinians respond to this right now, because it seems like, as we were saying before, the Netanyahu government adopted a strategy of if you must pay lip service at international forums or in the United States, you will say something vaguely about a two-state solution. But it seemed like Israel and certainly the Israeli center and center-right was getting comfortable with the notion of we can basically just hold on to these territories, maybe give some minimum PR concessions, and this can be a durable reality. Why not? Who's to say we can't manage this? Inside Palestine, and I think this has had an effect on the shifting view of the Palestinians, you talk about, and maybe we could kind of break this down. We've talked about Hamas. Then we have Abu Mazen, we have Fatah kind of representing the traditional Palestinian leadership. There's problems. There's something sclerotic there. But it's very moderate. It's very committed to the process. And then there's been this emerging civil society in Palestine, which has called for things like divestment and boycotts and has adopted a lot of nonviolent resistance strategies. So, I mean, is this a time where if the worst case scenario is an outbreak of violence and death that covers the whole region in blood and reaffirms narratives about the Palestinians and the Israelis? Or conversely, could this be the time that that really emerges in the public consciousness in an entirely new way, coming off of these shifts that you've already noted?
I think that the days in which the Israeli-Palestinian conflict had regional repercussions are frankly over. I mean, really, since the Iraq invasion.
I meant Israel-Palestine, just to be clear.
Within Israel-Palestine, it's going to have. But I do think that that's an important point, because it's a point that I used to make. I would make this constantly, that what happens in Israel-Palestine, what happens in Jerusalem, has repercussions across the region. And it's still true that should there be some negotiated two-state settlement, that would have a dramatic effect on other parts of the region. But, and I want to be as clear about this as I possibly can, so I'm going to use very precise language. If you are a person who still believes in a two-state solution, you are living in a fantasy world. There is no two-state solution. There will never, ever be an independent Palestinian state living alongside a safe and secure Israeli state. That time has come and gone. It's time to stop pretending that there's still any hope for that. And frankly, anyone who still continues to argue for such a thing is arguing about it because they are afraid to face the reality on the ground. There is no two-state solution. It's over. And it's over for a whole host of reasons, but it's over. Right. So what you're seeing now is the inevitable consequence of this slow deterioration into a binational state. And I'm not saying that simply because that's where public opinion is going anyway in Israel-Palestine. I'm not saying that because this year, 2014, represents a record year for number of settlements built in the occupied territories, a record that was beat by the record that was set last year. So there is no slowing down. There is no withdrawal of occupied lands. That's not happening. So what you're going to get is a situation whereby through conflict, through devastation, through war and bloodshed, we're going to finally get to a negotiated settlement of a binational state, because that's what's happening on the ground anyway. The last hope of a two-state solution from the Palestinian side rests in Abu Mazen, and the more he continues to play the role of peaceful moderator, the less popular he becomes in Palestine. And in any case, right, he has far more than outstayed his welcome as an unelected president of the Palestinian Authority. What you have in Israel, because of migration patterns and political realities, is a ruling class that has stopped even paying lip service to the two-state solution. Yes. You say that, you know, you said something about Bibi, you know, paying lip service to it. He hasn't, actually. He's just stopped. He hasn't mentioned the two-state solution in about 3 years, right, ever since Barack Obama forced him to do so. There is no interest in a two-state solution in the Israeli government at all. The ultra-Orthodox Shas don't want it. The Likud don't want it. Yisrael Beitenu does not want it. The parties that actually do want it have really no say or power at all. Just look at who the foreign minister is. Look at who the housing minister is in Israel. So enough. Enough pretending that there is a two-state solution. Now let's talk about something else. So I think moving forward here, what is going to be necessary is precisely that negotiation, that internal negotiation, whether it involves annexation, full citizenship, which would, of course, mean the end of Israel as a Jewish state. And as tragic as that statement may be, I hate to say this, but Israel made its bed and now it has to lie in it.
Well, there's land, democracy, and Judaism. You can't have all three.
You can't have all three. Right. As simple as that. Right. Everybody has always known that in Israel, and yet right, there's been this, pretending that you could.
Right.
So I think that the more there is greater external pressure on Israel to provide the kind of rights and privileges to the Palestinians that the Geneva Conventions demand, that its own Supreme Court has demanded, because Israel, of course, does not have a constitution, that the more you see that kind of pressure, the more you're going to see this sort of general acceptance of the reality on the ground, which is a binational state in which Israelis and Palestinians, regardless of your religious persuasion, are both nationalists and citizens with equal rights, equal representation, with perhaps something akin of what my friend Bernie Abishai refers to as a Hebrew republic, a state in which there are cultural and national right, symbols that represent Hebrew culture, in which there is a divided government with perhaps a Palestinian president and an Israeli prime minister. But that's where we are heading towards anyway. And we can either head towards it through bloodshed, violence, and conflict, or we can head towards it in a negotiated way. And unfortunately, because of the dominance of the two-state narrative, it seems like we're going to do this the hard way, not the easy way.
Yeah, I mean, the two-state has kind of become this sleight of hand that just sort of obfuscates not only – I mean, there's an idealistic desire for a binational solution among some people, but now as you're saying – I mean, there's just logistical practical geographic realities that are going to need to be dealt with. And I think, you know, as we move towards completing this conversation, do you think that that tracks what you're talking about with this shift in public opinion and with this shift in how this issue is being covered? Because, you know, I think it's not only are you seeing with, as an example, the really vicious beating of the American-Palestinian boy that happened and the coverage that's been receiving as an example. You're moving, it seems to me, the distinction is not just, well, let's be a little bit more complex about it. There's two political players here with their own competing agendas, and they're both making mistakes and they're old flawed. That's one thing, and that still very much exists within a framework of two states, two peoples trying to determine a political settlement. But then the other shift that does seem to be occurring, which I have definitely not seen in American mainstream media before, which is striking, is just the kind of emergence is just sort of a, I guess, just a straight human rights issue, essentially, which seems to me that that's the kind of essential thing that will need to be dealt with and is just a reality under this binational necessity that you're talking about.
Well, look, I mean, I think Americans, it's sort of in our cultural DNA, is that we root for the underdog. And part of the reason why Israel has had American sympathies for so long is that for a very, very long time, Israel was the underdog. Right. But it's not anymore, right? This is the whole Max Blumenthal Goliath syndrome. It's that, you know, I'm sorry, but by no circumstances, by no measurements, by no calculation whatsoever, is Israel any longer the underdog. It's the most powerful, one of the wealthiest nations in the world. It has an army that could destroy its neighbors in a heartbeat. It has nuclear weapons that could turn its enemies into glass if it wanted to. And internally, it is by far no longer a country that is besieged on all sides by terror and by enemies. I mean, that idea, you know, which is still the narrative that you hear over and over again, is just simply a fallacy. It's a joke. And so I think the more that Americans recognize that it's not Israel that's the underdog anymore, it's the Palestinians who are, the more their sentiments are going to be, are going to shift towards the Palestinian cause, which is again why I decry the idea of another armed uprising, because that would shift things very, very quickly. I mean, Israel is very good at propagating its you know, image as this kind of, you know, what they love to say, but the only democracy in the region. Well, it's not a very good democracy. It's not an equal democracy. It's a democracy that makes a distinction between citizenship and nationalism. It's a democracy that's ethno-nationalistic. It's a democracy that doesn't give rights to all of its citizens, certainly not its Palestinian citizens. Right. It's a democracy that is profoundly unequal. And so, you know, those things are becoming clearer and clearer to outsiders and even to Americans. And I think that that's the real existential threat to Israel. The real existential threat to Israel. Sorry, those are my children crying in the background.
Hey, guys.
The real existential threat to Israel comes from the loss of support. I mean, it's already lost Europe. You know, it could very well lose the United States.
Yeah, and those three narratives that going from we were persecuted and we're under attack, and then there's the these are two people who've always fought, and we need a two states for two people, and then to the straight, yeah, one group is the underdog, and there is just some basic human rights questions. When we get there, then that raises a completely fundamentally different set of questions and a fundamentally different set of answers. And I appreciate your time immensely, Reza, and hopefully this will head in a nonviolent and durable direction.
Yeah, let's hope.
All right, thanks so much.
Take care.
All right, folks. So I think that gives you a pretty good sense of what the game is over there right now. And I think, obviously, I mean, my Jewish identity has never been very strongly connected. You know, I've been to Israel, certainly know many Israelis and Palestinians. I mean, there obviously is a distinction. If you have had a family member who's died in a terrorist attack, in a Hamas suicide bombing or rocket attack, and there's also a distinction, frankly, if you're living in occupation every day. I mean, look, I remember I went, spent just an afternoon, not very much time at all. I went to Ramallah in the West Bank. I was traveling with somebody. And, you know, you go in by bus, and it's no problem. You wave right through, and you're in a completely different reality. I mean, you're going from a tremendously wealthy country. You pass by all sorts of settlements, development, and then you go inside, and you're in, you know, what they call this iron cage. And that's quite accurate. And waiting on the line to get back into Israel. And you're waiting online. There's no, you know, you're online with everybody else. And this is what people go through every day. They're under the gaze of machine guns. They're moving through iron barriers. To move a couple of miles in a place that they've been in generations. And, you know, in our holidays, we have I'm such a bad part Jew that I don't remember. I think it's Passover. We say next year in Jerusalem, right? Because that's a history of exodus and persecution of the Jewish people. Well, in today's reality, we go to Jerusalem whenever the hell we want, right? That's not a problem. But people who've lived there for generations don't have basic freedom of movement. And that needs to be accounted for. And any narrative, I think, again, I think we've moved from a dehumanization narrative to a, well, both sides are idiots, we can't deal with it, throw your hands up narrative. And now I will say, well, of course, there are groups like Hamas that are disgusting and deplorable, and there are innocent people killed on both sides. If you're ignoring the fundamental asymmetry of the situation, then you have a fundamentally delusional view of the situation. And that's the bottom line.
It's good to switch things up sometimes.
It's good to switch things up all the time, yes.
It's good to switch things
up. Okay, so let's get right to it. What should I... Okay. This story is something, and I guess it's one to start with because it's just pretty unbelievable, Michael Brooks.
It is indeed unbelievable.
Okay, so over in the UK, Lee Setford, a bricklayer, has been sentenced to 5 years in prison for rape. But the judge who sentenced him is the real story here. Judge Michael Metier had told Setford, the man who was just sentenced to 5 years for rape, that it's sad to see a man of generally good character in the dock for such a serious offense. He continued that he is not a general danger to strangers. I do not regard you as a classic rapist. A classic rapist.
I got nothing.
I do not regard you as a classic rapist. This was a case where you just lost control of normal restraint. You are not the type who goes searching for women to rape. Are you kidding me? So the jury...
Your classic rapist will engage in rape rather often. He might ply a young lady with alcohol. You, sir, you merely wait to see a young lady drunk because you are not a classic rapist.
Actually, the judge spoke about the victim's behavior, too.
Unbelievable.
Here we go.
I didn't want to hear this.
It was almost out of the blue that two girls turned up late at night very, very drunk at your home. The poor baby! Oh, these women just showed up drunk at his doorstep. What is a man to do but rape? The victim was the worst for drink out of the two of them. She was completely out of it. This is a judge talking.
This is a judge who should immediately have an investigation opened for his rape.
This guy definitely has raped someone. Are you kidding me?
Absolutely.
She was completely out of it. I accept that evidence. She was a pretty girl who you fancied. You simply could not resist. You had sex with her. Well, the jury did find this guy unanimously guilty of rape after deliberating for basically no more than 2.5 hours, which basically means they didn't believe this guy was an innocent man whatsoever. But the judge, though, did have these very harsh words for Setford. And why did he have these harsh words for Setford? Is it because he raped? No. It's because he didn't plead guilty. So the judge didn't have to give him a 5-year sentence. Do you believe that? It's a great shame you did not have the courage to say, "I have made a terrible mistake and I am sorry." That would have made it much easier for her, and I could have passed a lighter sentence.
You are breaking my heart,
You're
sir.
Breaking my heart, sir, that I have to sentence you to 5 years. Why do I have to follow the law, damn you?
Help me help you.
Oh, my God. Chaney and Bushes, for the record, producer Emeritus Josh, I'm fully cognizant that asking for my theme song makes me sound like an asshole. I regret nothing. Oh, this is from, yes, this was fun. That was from Friday. I'm sorry.
We gotta be a little bit more careful. I mean, I think a-hole is fine, but I'm just thinking.
We'll be editing it for the podcast, so it won't matter when it comes down to.
Well,
it.
Fair point.
This is already the better half.
It's already the better half. You're damn right.
Militant Apathy.
Well, an uptake.
Oh shit, son! My favorite Nas track. There you go, Michael.
Beautiful.
Okay, so what the fuck is going on with the rape obsession with conservatives? When did this happen? That plus the attack on birth control is very strange.
Well, what's happening, again, and we've said this before, and this is the reason we cover this stuff in all of its various manifestations.
Speaking.
Just because, wait one second.
Okay.
This is what you want to get to. Every time you get to an issue, you want to get to the fundamental driver. The fundamental driver of energy policy in the GOP, as an example, is the extractive energy industry. The fundamental driver of all of these things, and it's so simple, is misogyny.
Oh, for sure.
If you cannot deal with women as sexual beings. You can't deal in everything. And really, you know, like all of these stereotypical comments, you know, Madonna whore complex, all this. The bottom line is misogyny. That's what drives it. That's why a grown person could say something as ludicrous and as demented as what that judge said. And that's why, incidentally, I mean, this happens. It's misogyny. That's it. All right, go ahead.
Where's the cricket sound? I needed that. Damn. Oh, well. Well, speaking of misogynists, I woke up this morning to a very interesting tweet from a men's rights activist, Michael. As listeners of this show might recall, on the previous Matt and Michael Monday show, I covered the men's rights, men's rights conference, where a bunch of sad men got together and instead of bringing up valid points, they attacked feminism and women in general.
And I just really briefly told them to man up.
Yes. Yeah. And it seems like they may have heard you. Because this morning I woke up and someone sent me a link to the website A Voice for Men, which is, well, they call themselves the leading website for men's rights activists and the men's rights movement. They are the ones who actually put together the first annual men's rights conference that took place last weekend. And the article I was sent to has the headline, "A Challenge to Matt Binder." Now, for those of you who are not familiar, that is me. I am Matt Binder. It seems like they saw my segment where I covered the first annual men's rights conference, and they are none too happy with my coverage of said event. Paul Ellum, who is the founder of A Voice for Men, had this to say. "Okay, I am going to have to start by saying I have never heard of the guy. Someone in the comments of my YouTube channel put a link to the following video where Matt sets about what he imagines is a pawning, P-W-N-I-N-G, which is the nerd way of writing owning if you are a 12-year-old Call of Duty player, of a Voice for Men's conference on men's issues. Yes, it was lame. Yes, he mispronounced virtually everyone's name he mentioned. And yes, he really thought he was making good points, even as he fumble-fucked his way through a subject he did not understand. He was like Chris Gethard sans the Coke bottle glasses and even less funny, which I take as a compliment. I mean, you're basically saying I am not as funny as a very funny comedian, so I guess I'm sort of funny? I mean,
I'm going to steal fumble-fucked.
Yeah.
I'll again, give him that.
Again, another phrase someone who drinks gamer fuel and plays Call of Duty probably uses.
I won't steal it.
He continues, okay, Matt, you're barely marginal in an unchallenged environment where you are free to misrepresent, lie, twist, distort, mock, parrot, and commit other forms of intellectual flatulence just so you can appeal to women who live with seven or more cats. Excuse you, Paul. Excuse you. I don't consider women unless they have a minimum of 10 cats. Excuse you. How do you think you would do in a real live debate where there is more of a response to what you have to say than you laughing at your own unfunny shit? You made a lot of statements about what you think is the weakness of the men and apparently the women of A Voice for Men. How dare those women who are part of A Voice for Men speak up, though? That's what I'm questioning.
That's what I'm saying.
That implies some sort of strength on your part. It certainly does, buddy. Certainly does. You are being offered a chance to prove it. Oh, boy. I will predict to my readers that the response to this will be either a mocking rejection. Well, mocking truly is, you got that part right. Rejection, we'll see. Or crickets. Ooh. This is generally how feminist quizlings roll. So I really just wanted to get this on record. It's another example that underneath every yapping feminist chihuahua sycophant is a yapping feminist chihuahua sycophant. Ooh.
Wow.
I fancy myself more of a yapping feminist shih tzu, excuse you.
No, I think you're more of a chihuahua. As I listen to this guy, I've not heard this before. I just have to say, sounds to me like somebody got called short by their wife.
Oh,
by
yes.
Their ex-wife.
Yes, it does sound like that to me. He goes on to say that if I don't want to debate another male, that there's other options for me. And he proceeds to go through the other voice for the women's B team, I guess you would call them, of A Voice for Men. Because the A team is clearly men.
The B team?
They have to be.
B team.
B team. I mean.
Okay.
What?
Nothing. I was just thinking of what a B word that these guys might throw around.
I didn't even think of that. Maybe that is why. Yeah. But then he goes that if for whatever reason you would like to do this, the only condition applied to the offer is equal time with you shutting the fuck up when it is not your turn to speak.
Oh, my God. Is this Walter Block?
Is this Walter Block? Yeah, no. Hey. It's my turn now. I will do the same. Up to you, Maddie. But I am betting on the crickets. Well, Paul, crickets you shall not get. Because I accept your challenge, and I accept the original challenge of debating a man. And while the level of testosterone you have may be frightening to me, I accept. And I will bring the maximum amount of testicular fortitude I can muster up in my small-framed feminist body. My Coke-bottled glasses non-wearing, even less funny Chris Gethard body. And I accept your challenge, buddy. And I will attempt to give you equal time as long as you're not boring as shit. Because after all, it has to be entertaining because this is a audio show. In the podcast or live radio format. And it could get very boring if you just yap on forever without any interruption. spouting out MRA platitudes and ideology. You name the time and place, buddy. Let's do this. Well, the time and place is obviously the Majority Report.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
Monday's 12 noon.
Yeah, to be more specific.
Yes. We will accept your
Monday
challenge.
Monday at noon.
My wife! She's taking my money. She's taking my money.
All right, folks.
All right. We will see you in the better half of the show. Oh, we should do a members call as if we're ending the show. You can support this show by becoming a member at majority.fm. You could just click become a member. It's less than a cup of coffee a day. And by doing so, you support independent media. You can also support this show by buying all your junk through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. Another way to support this show that costs you $0 is by going to majorityapp.com and downloading our free app. It is a great way to turn people onto this show. It is just a fantastic way to turn people onto this show because they can download the app and listen to a show in a way that maybe they don't know how to download a podcast. Maybe it's just a new experience to them. And just listening through an application is easier. YouTube.com/Sam Cedar. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel. YouTube.com/Majority Report Live, where you can watch us live on our YouTube stream every day, Monday through Friday at 12 noon. At Majority FM, follow us on Twitter. Facebook.com/Majority Report. Like us on Facebook. JustCoffee.coop. Use coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off Fair Trade coffee and chocolates. We will see you in the better half. Oh, you got to press go to soundboard. Click La Poupée.